I suppose mostly when we think of war, which we do on Remembrance Sunday, on war and on its victims, and when we reflect on what we owe to other people, I suppose mostly we think of soldiers and sailors and airmen. We think of people who are in uniform, who have the responsibility to fight, who are on the front line, as it were. It's the names of people like that that we've just read out in our service this morning and remembered, people who fought like that and who gave their lives. But you know, without support services, they couldn't fight. Armaments manufacturers, the people who actually make the armaments that they use to pursue the enemy, food and medicine without being able to eat and without having nursing care so that those who are injured can be healed and restored to health, and without communication so that they can talk to each other and know what one another is doing. Without these and lots of other support services, you couldn't fight a war. But to fight a war effectively, you also need something else. You need information. To fight an enemy, you need to understand your enemy. You need to know who he is and what he is doing, what resources he has available, and what he's attempting to carry out right now. And that information is vital. Otherwise, you're working in the dark. And for generations, that's been an important part of warfare. So we're thinking maybe particularly about the First and Second World Wars this morning, the whole issue of reconnaissance, which towards the end of the First War and throughout the Second World War was done entirely by aircraft who could overfly and who could take photographs of what was happening on the ground. They could go and help target bombers, and then they could go and look afterwards to see if they destroyed the targets they were meant to destroy. They could see the movements of armies. They could get a lot of information from the air looking down. And so reconnaissance became a key thing. Another thing that helped out was if you captured enemy prisoners, you could interrogate them and get them to tell you what they were supposed to be doing when they were captured. And you could have spies. You could have people who actually become part of the enemy war machine, but who send you back information about what they're doing. And all those things were part of warfare since time immemorial. The technology has changed, but the idea of using information to frustrate an enemy has not changed. One of the greatest sources of information on your enemy's activities is his messages. The messages that he sends to his troops and those who are involved by sea or by air. If you can read his messages, then you know what he's doing. And in Remembrance Sundays over the last number of years, I've tried to look at some different aspect each year of warfare and reflect on that and what we can learn from that, what we need to remember and give thanks to God for, but also what we can learn from that. We are a Christian church. In the 21st century, we are seeking to be witnesses for Jesus Christ. We find ourselves in a hostile environment. There is an enemy. We've been thinking about him in our services this autumn. We've been experiencing his power and his work among us at times. What can we learn from this about the enemy we face right now as Christians and believers in our generation? So I want to reflect and look back on what happened this morning in the Second World War. Because in the Second World War, part of the ultimate success of the Allies was dependent upon their ability to read German messages. And that part of the war has entered into folklore, as has the place particularly associated with it. A place called Bletchley Park in mainland UK, where a team of people were based whose responsibility it was to break German codes. And it's entered into our folklore, as I say, the place itself, Bletchley Park, and a machine called Enigma, invented by the Germans that they used. So much part of our folklore is this that, for example, the whole history of what happened and how those German codes were broken has resulted in, just in recent years, in two different films. There was, first of all, U-571, which was the American version of the story and bears as much relationship to the truth as Mickey Mouse does. However, it's a really good film and it's a good watch, okay? And to be fair to the makers, they never claimed that it was meant to be history. They just kind of used the search for the Enigma machine to construct a really interesting film. So you might have seen it. If you hadn't, it's worth watching. There was a British reply which attempted to get a little bit nearer to the truth. It's called Enigma, and you probably never heard of it. It was a total flop. But it is quite an interesting film as well, and you can get it on DVD also. And it tries to kind of correct the balance and looks at 1942, 1943, when the code breakers had a particular problem and how they solved that problem at that time. And it attempts to tell the story. But the fact that even so many years after the event that we're still making movies about this, and that there are literally hundreds of books that have been written, even though for years and years and years the government released no information on what happened at Bletchley Park, and much of it actually is still held secret under the Official Secrets Act. Many of the people who worked there are now dead, of course, and have taken their secrets with them to the grave. But more information has come out. There's lots of books. I've been reading this one, which is Enigma, The Battle for the Code, by a guy called Hugh Sebag Montefiore. It's an amazing name. Interesting author, because actually his family owned Bletchley Park, and he used to visit it as a boy and run around it in summertime, and then it was taken over during the war and used for this purpose. So I want to think and reflect a little bit this morning on that particular part of the Second World War. Now, I know you're probably sitting there thinking, boy, John, this is a really geeky thing to be talking about, you know, breaking codes and all that sort of thing. Well, I hope I can maybe give you a little bit of an interest in it and draw from it some lessons that I think we can learn. To protect their messages, okay, because in the day of the Second World War, the communication was not as sophisticated as it is now. There were no satellites and all that kind of stuff. So basically, the only way by which the Germans could keep in touch with their troops and their the members of the Air Force, and in particular those who were involved with the war at sea, was by Morse code, by radio messages in Morse code, dots and dashes, okay? But obviously, the advantage, the kind of disadvantage about Morse code is anybody with a radio receiver can pick it up once you find the frequency. And so, everybody knows how Morse code is constructed, so you can read your enemy's messages. So the Germans had to come up with a means to encode the messages. And the means they came up with was this, the Enigma machine. Now, there are lots of different variations of it. You go home and Google Enigma machine, you'll come up with all sorts of different pictures that kind of explain the machine. But basically what the machine was, it had a keyboard. Underneath the keyboard there was a plug board, and above it there were three or four wheels, and each wheel had the letters of the alphabet around it. And what happened was, when you pressed one of the keys, which was just a standard typewriter keyboard, that sent an electrical signal that was diverted through the plug board and then through the wheels, and it lit up a light with a letter in it. So you maybe type the letter A, and the light lit up for, let's say, the letter S. And so for A, you sent S, and so on. And that's how the system basically worked. Now, the machine was quite complicated, and what actually happened was that it could be changed in all sorts of different ways. There were three wheels in the early machines. Later, there were four. So that gave you all those combinations of the wheels that could be in different positions. Then the plug board had a whole series of interconnections that could be changed as well. And that gave you literally hundreds of millions of possibilities. So that was how they invented a system that made for a very secure form of encoding and sending a message. So the operative typed at the keyboard, observed the letters, sent them by Morse code. The operative at the other end received them by Morse code and unscrambled the message. Now, because he had one of the machines as well. The Germans had different systems for all three services, for the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. And it transpired that those for the Army and the Air Force were not that difficult to break. And throughout most of the war, the Allies were successfully able to read German messages to their forces on the ground and also to their forces in the air. But for Britain, obviously, the most important enigma was the naval enigma, the machine that was used to encode messages that were sent to submarines and battle cruisers and so on that were in the Atlantic and that were all around the British Isles and who were seeking to destroy the convoys on their ways from America to supply Europe. So the British really needed to read, badly needed to read, those naval messages. And they were the most difficult codes to break. The story of breaking the code begins before the war, and it doesn't involve the English at all. Because Polish emigres who had fled their own country after Germany invaded it came to France, and they actually started in France, because they had discovered about the Enigma machine, and they began to make an attempt to break the code. And actually, before the war, they had had some success with those efforts. They were also aided by the fact that there was a spy, which kind of makes this a little bit more sexy than it otherwise would be, because there's a spy involved in it, okay? It's not just a machine. The spy was Hans Thilo Schmidt, who was a German with quite important connections and who was actually able to access information about the codes. And he brought that information to his handler in France, and that helped the Polish emigres begin the work of breaking the code. Eventually, when the war broke out, that responsibility moved largely from France to England and to Bletchley Park and to the cryptographers who worked there. The reality is this, that even though the Naval Enigma was such a difficult code to break, for most of the Second World War, the British were able to read German messages. Not always at the time they were sent, but they were able to glean information, at least at some point, in virtually the whole of the Second World War. How was this possible? I want us to look at the reasons why they were able to do that and what we can learn from that. How was it possible? Well, here's the first reason why it was possible. Because, surprisingly enough, they faced a complacent enemy. Our impression of the German war machine is that it's like the Volkswagen car company. You know, it's Vorsprung der Technik, or however you say those. Sorry to my daughter for being so bad at pronouncing German. But we kind of think that's the way the Germans are. They just get everything right, you know. They do it really well. And so during the war, they were really well organized. And, you know, they had invented this machine. And probably because they invented it, you definitely couldn't crack it. Actually, they contributed to their own defeat for a number of reasons. The first one was this. Naval communications didn't just involve vital messages to submarines and cruisers and destroyers and aircraft carriers to give them instructions about where they should go next and what their targets should be and so on. They also involved very ordinary mundane things. For example, every single day during the war, the Germans sent a message to all their ships at sea giving them the weather forecast. Because you had no other way of getting it in those days. So they would send out the weather forecast to the submarines and ships that were at sea. They would also send them other messages about things that were happening that everybody knew about. And so the result of that was that because they sent, for example, these weather messages, and because the British were often able to locate where a submarine or where a destroyer was, because when the signal was received, they could do that clever thing that nowadays they can do with your mobile phone. So you can actually find out where you are if you carry a mobile phone with you and you have it in your bag or your pocket and it's switched on. Some people with very nefarious intentions can find out where you are. And it was the same principle they were able to use during the war to locate the submarine. When they located the submarine, they could then look at the text of the weather forecast that they knew was being sent out, and they could maybe find or discover some of the words in the weather forecast. Like, for example, the portion of the ocean where the submarine was based. The message would somewhere say that, or it would give the name of the weather station that was sending the forecast. And so you could pick that out. You could then use that to figure out some of the letters. And that was what they did. And all through the war, they used these simple weather forecast messages to give them a key to break the code. So by simple things that the Germans did, they made it more difficult for themselves. Second thing was this, human habits. When you got an Enigma machine and you were a German operative and you had to set it up, what actually happened was each day you were given a position for the three wheels or four wheels, depending on how many you had, and you had a starting position that you put the wheels in, okay? Then whenever you'd done that, what you were then supposed to do is you were supposed to jumble them up. And then what you did then was you sent out as the first part of your message how you had jumbled the letters up, and it was just a code of about four letters. Now what happened was this. Most Germans were just like us. They couldn't be bothered turning all the wheels around. So what they tended to do was they moved the same wheel each day. And you could tell an operative, apparently the person who sent Morse code, everybody who sends Morse code has a kind of a signature of their own, and you get to know who that person is. And by getting to know who was sending the message, they knew who the operative was, and they knew that he always changed the second wheel. And he never varied that habit. And so when they were trying to work out all the possible permutations, they could eliminate a whole lot of them because they knew this guy only moves the second wheel. Human habits, really simple things that made what should have been virtually an unbreakable code able to be broken because of what this person did. So they had predictable patterns of behavior. Also, the Germans never used the machine to its full capability. They never used all the plug board connections, and often they didn't use possible wheel combinations. So it was easy, it was not easy, but it was easier to break the code because of that. Human habits. The third thing was this, overconfidence. The British had a problem. Once they started to be able to read the Enigma machine and the messages that it was that were being sent out through it, the British had to decide, did they use that information? For example, suppose because of that information you knew that a particular German battleship was about to sail from a particular port to carry out a particular task. Should you send bombers to blast it out of the water? Well, your immediate answer would be, well, why wouldn't you do that? You had the information, why not use it? Because then the Germans would think to themselves, how did they know about that? And if the Germans figured out that the Enigma code had been broken by the British, they would obviously have done something drastic to change it. So there was always a balancing act that had to be made between should we use the information we have or not. Sometimes the British did, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes people who were out there at sea, maybe the captain of a destroyer or leading a battle group at sea, would maybe be a little bit more risk-taking than his commanding officers on shore would have liked, and he had the information, he decided to act on it. And several times during the war, if the Germans had thought about it, they would have realized their codes were broken. But they had various inquiries into this, and almost every inquiry said, yes, the codes might be being broken, but actually it's such a good system, it's highly unlikely. And so even though the evidence was staring them in the face that the British were reading their messages, they never actually responded to that because they were so confident in their systems. So the first thing that helped the British to break the German codes was the complacent enemy. They thought they had a perfect system that could never be destroyed. It reminded me when I was reading the book, if you've seen the film The Passion of the Christ, and if you remember at the end of the film, how after Jesus is raised from the dead, there's a scene where the Satan character in the film is in a pit screaming his head off. Why is he doing that? Because all of a sudden he realizes that he has engineered the death of the Son of God. And for him that was a matter of great celebration. Jesus had been crucified. Jesus was gone. He had won the ultimate victory. And he was so confident about what he had done. But when Jesus was raised from the grave on the third day, he realized that by engineering the killing of the Son of God, he had unwittingly saved mankind. And what he thought was a victory was actually a defeat. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 36, it says this. This is Peter preaching on the day of Pentecost. Therefore, let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. We're inclined to be afraid of the enemy we face. We're inclined to think that Satan is amazingly powerful, knows everything, is able to frustrate the purposes of God, and forget, as I was saying a few weeks ago in our series on angels and demons, that he is a creature, not the equivalent of God. And that the greatest victory he thought he won was his greatest defeat. And that in our lives, seeking to live as believers in our generation and to face up to the difficulties, animosity, and hostility that is all around us, need to remember we face a complacent enemy who thinks he is invincible, but who, by the power of God, through the death and resurrection of Christ, is already defeated, disarmed, and unable to destroy the purposes of God. Let us not be upset by a complacent enemy. Because in the case of the Enigma machine, it was one of the reasons the Germans were defeated. Second thing about the Enigma machine is this. That Bletchley Park succeeded because of unlikely heroes. All sorts of people helped to break the Enigma code. There were Polish emigres, we've already mentioned, who were living and working in France, some of whom eventually lost their lives when the Germans invaded France. There was the German spy, Hans Thilo Schmidt, whom we talked about a moment or two ago, who gave really valuable information. There were British and American naval crews, sometimes submariners and sometimes surface crews, who captured German submarines or armed German trawlers. The Germans used to use trawlers in disguise, really. They looked like trawlers. Actually, they were naval craft that were doing various things around the coast of Norway and Scandinavia and down as far as these islands, actually. But those trawlers actually were German warships. And they all had Enigma machines on board, and those Enigma machines contained the code books that enabled the operative to know where he should start his wheels each day. And during the war, on several important occasions, British and American naval crews boarded these vessels and got the Enigma machines and the code books. Often this was a very dangerous thing to be doing. If you boarded a submarine which had just surfaced because it was damaged, what usually happened was, as the German crew were leaving, the captain of that ship would have opened the valves, let the water in to sink the boat. And you maybe had 2 minutes before that submarine would go down. And British crews and American crews were jumping onto these submarines, going down the conning tower, not knowing what they would find beneath, hoping to get some information that they needed and get out of the thing again before it sank. A number of people lost their lives in trying to get this material and bringing it back to Britain. But the most unlikely heroes were the people who worked at Bletchley Park. Mostly, they were not the kind of people you associate with war at all. They were highly intelligent Oxbridge students, some of them as young as 18 years of age, most of them brilliant at mathematics. For example, there was a guy called Alan Turing, who was one of the top men at Bletchley Park, absolutely brilliant, a fellow of King's College, Cambridge, at only 22 years of age, and only 26 himself when war broke out. He was a really unusual character to find prominence in the society of his day. For one thing, he was homosexual, which was really unusual in a public figure in an age like this. He was eccentric and totally brilliant. He was possibly autistic, or suffered from Asperger's syndrome. It's hard to know, but features of his life, looking back on it now, would appear to be in that category. He was a complete loner, but he was absolutely brilliant. He invented a machine which was able to test all the possible combinations of the Enigma machine for a given day. Once you knew some things about it, they could run this machine, and in maybe 10, 12, 13, 14 hours, this machine would go through every single possible combination available on that day and come up with the code. And he invented this machine, and they built it. Eventually, the Americans built large numbers of them as well. And he was just a completely brilliant person, really clever, but probably you wouldn't want to have him as a friend. But he didn't get on very well either with most of the other people that he worked with. In particular, one other person who, strictly speaking, was his boss, because the cryptographers at Bletchley Park had been working for quite a long while, an older generation. And like most older generations, they despised young people because they thought, what would they know anyway? So this man, Alan Turing's boss, that's the way he looked at him. He thought, well, he's young. He thinks he knows everything, but I know more than him. His name was Dilly Knox. And there he is. He was also weird. Again, a really brilliant man, but totally eccentric. Apparently, in his office at Bletchley Park, there were two doors. One was a door out of the office into the corridor, and the other was a door into a cupboard. And every single day in life, Dilly Knox went into the cupboard instead of going out the door and into the corridor. And he didn't just do it once and then remember that was the cupboard. He did it every single day. He went into the cupboard and then realized he was in the cupboard and had to come back out again and go through the other door into the corridor. He was like a man who didn't actually have a relationship with life in the real world at all. Apparently, he lived in Bletchley Park, and most days people would see him wandering around in his pajamas and dressing gown. He didn't realize he hadn't dressed for the day. He also liked to have attractive young women around him, and he would trawl the staff in all the departments in Bletchley Park and get them to move anyone to his office who was young and attractive. Particularly, there was a woman called Mavis Lever, who actually wrote this book of Dilly's life, and he formed a really close relationship with her. It wasn't in any way a sexual relationship or anything like that. They just became really, really close friends. But so much so, he became so protective of her that when she fell in love with another member, young man who was a member of staff there, he did everything he could to break them up. And so all these kind of unusual and weird individuals turned out to be absolutely vital to the war effort. You wouldn't have chosen any of them, probably, if you were going to pick a group of people to win a war for you. And yet the reality was that because of their gifts and skills, however odd or weird or difficult they were as people, they became really successful, and they were part of a victorious war effort. Unlikely heroes. Look at the church. What do we look like? Are we not the most unlikely bunch of heroes you've ever seen? We're just ordinary people. Do you remember what Paul said about the church at Corinth? Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise, influential, or of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. These unlikely heroes, these unusual people, who turned out to be the key element in working out how this code could be broken, remind us of the fact that really ordinary people like you and I, some of us too are probably a bit eccentric as well. We may not go into cupboards instead of going out the door, but no doubt we do all sorts of other things that appear weird to other people. And Paul said that was God's plan, actually. That was God's plan. He took uninfluential, unimportant, unlovely people, and he did an amazing thing in their lives. And through doing that amazing thing in their lives, he intends to win the world. What an amazing opportunity that is. We can be odd. We can be eccentric. We can be ourselves and still be of use to the living God. Unlikely heroes. That's what we're called to be. And then the last reason why Bletchley Park was successful was this. It's persistent focus. That picture on screen, it's a bit hard to see because of the light on the screen, but that's a reconstruction of the machine that Alan Turing invented during the war. If I put it back together again, you can visit now and see in Bletchley Park, you can see the huts where some of these people worked, and you can see these machines that were used to crack the code. What you have to understand is that there was no one decisive victory in the race to break the code. If you watch U571, don't believe the film. It didn't actually happen like that. There was no one decisive moment when it was all done. What you have to understand about the Enigma machine was if you could break the code for today, that was great. But remember, the code is going to change tomorrow because the operative was going to change at least one of the wheels in his machine. The starting point was going to change as well because his code book would give him that. And every month, all those codes were scrapped and a complete new set of codes came in. So it was a constant battle. And when you worked something out and you thought, brilliant, we got it for today, and that maybe worked for 2 or 3 days, and then you had to start all over again. And there was this persistent focus that they have to have. The biggest problem was that in 1942, the Germans thought the British were actually beginning to read their messages. So in the case of the naval Enigma, they added a fourth wheel. I'm not a mathematician. I can't tell you how many extra possibilities that gave to the equation, but it runs into millions. And so that made the problem much more difficult. And actually, when the Germans added the fourth wheel to the naval Enigma for 10 months in 1942 and running into early 1943, the British couldn't read any messages at all. So this battle was a constant search every day to find keys, to use those weather forecasts or other information they had to work out a few letters and then use those letters to break the rest of the code. This was every day of life. These people come into work every morning and did the same thing 5 years, every single day. How boring, you know, must that have been, unless you were a weird mathematician who got a kick out of it. But for normal people, that would be a slow death. It would be awful. But that's what they did, and they persisted at it, and they didn't give up, and they did it every day. And when they didn't break the code today, they had to go tomorrow, because maybe they'd break it tomorrow. And often they did. And their perseverance was worth it. I read that it is reckoned that through the work of the people in Bletchley Park, the war was shortened by at least 2 years. That if the British had been unable to read the messages, the war would have lasted at least another 2 years. Think of all the lives that were saved by that. And that was just because of these people coming in every morning and doing this really boring job. And what they did, although in itself there was no one great breakthrough, it aided other amazing breakthroughs during the war. For example, one of the problems that the British had when they eventually began to read the Naval Enigma and were able to destroy the submarines, and you remember we talked about that last year on Remembrance Day, but they still had threats from other German vessels at sea. Some incredible battleships like the Tirpitz, for example, which was an amazing battleship, and the Scharnhorst. The sinking of both of those ships was down to Bletchley Park and the ability to read German messages. Scharnhorst in particular was hidden away up north beyond Norway. And the Germans, it was such a large and such a powerful battleship, but because it was so large, it made a really easy target. So the Germans could only use it in certain conditions, and they wanted to use it to destroy Atlantic convoys. And because Bletchley Park was able, on a key moment of time, to read a particular German message, they knew what the Scharnhorst was going to do. And because of that, they sent a battle group, and that ship was fatally damaged and ultimately sunk, as was the Tirpitz, because of that information. Also, the D-Day landings. Key to the safety of Allied troops landing on D-Day was the ability to read those German naval messages, so that they knew exactly where the hunter-killer packs of submarines were, so that the ships could avoid that, and so that the air cover and protection could be given to the ships that were taking the Allied forces to land on the French beaches. It was just a really important part of it. The persistent focus of some individuals doing the same boring job every day of their lives saved lives and allowed the war to be won. And isn't that why Paul says, when he writes to the Ephesians, "And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the saints." Prayer is not the easiest work. It can be repetitive. It can be unattractive. You don't get recognition for being somebody who devotes time in a private place to prayer. Nobody even knows, perhaps, that you do it. For Jesus said, that's the way you should pray. And yet the persistent focus of crying out to God for his guidance and his power, doing the sort of thing that Desi did this morning in our prayers of intercession, but doing it privately when no one else is around, Paul said that's the key. You cannot know what that will do, any more than these guys slaving every day trying to crack this ridiculous code could possibly know what the significance of that work that they did really was. They were never outside the hut, rarely outside those buildings. They didn't know what was happening in the war because they didn't get that information given to them. They just had to come up with the code for today. When you kneel, you don't know. When you pray for that individual, pray for that situation, pray against the powers of darkness, when you do that, and when you become persistent at that, you don't know what incredible good you do. It was really simple things that broke the code and defeated the enemy. It was the enemy's own complacency. He's not as great as he thinks he is. He's not even as great as we think he is. Not only so, but there are these unlikely heroes, you and I. Just ordinary people. We don't have great intellect, great skills, great gifts. But Paul said God wants people like us. Because when he uses people like us, it's obvious that it had to be him and not us that made the difference. And persistent focus. These people stuck at the job for 5 long years, doing the same thing every day. But because they did that, the war was won. The code was broken. And if we could just find again the significance and importance of the place of prayer, and understand though nobody sees, and though nobody gives you awards and recognition for doing it, that actually you will never know until Jesus returns what that persistent focus has achieved.